So, Rabo, dude, welcome to the show. It took me getting you on the podcast to realize that your name is actually Mark. So I feel a little bit freaked out by that.
That's too funny. I have a lot of Marks. Well, my Mark's a pretty common name, but my father was also Mark, and I had a Mark that lived across the street from me that was a good pal of mine. So ever since I can remember, I was Rabo. And now, you know, at my work and the Mark that we met through also being a Mark kind of puts us in the last name territory here.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're talking to a Matthew Thompson here, one of 20 right. trillion on the planet. So I feel your pain, bro. Don't worry about it. And yeah, even in normal baths alone, I think we have like a system going where it's like, wait, is it Mark 1, 2, 3, or 4? Because the core staff team there, like they all have a key Mark in their life. And we're like, oh my goodness, we're drowning in a sea of Marks. So Rabo's cool. I like Rabo. You know, that can be your pen name or your stage name at the very least. So we met for the first time kind of accidentally for dinner at a great place called Booba, and it was the launch of Mark Dowds, who we've loosely mentioned already, his new company Responsible, who you're working for. And it was just this incredible night of sharing and lots of different food. It was like a tasting menu. I don't know how many courses there were, but they were all excellent. And people just sat randomly and allowed the conversations to take them where they went. And so we had the chance to catch up probably over the course of 2 or 3 hours and really, really enjoyed our conversation. And I guess where I'd like to start this conversation is tell us about the notes file on your phone that you use to record. I can't remember the exact language that you use, but the way I've interpreted it is beautiful things or moments of intense beauty that you want to keep coming back to. So flesh that out a little bit for us. Why did you start doing that, and give us an example of some of the things that are in that file?
There's a podcast called Song Exploder, and it's a podcast where the host Rishi Keshurway, he talks to different artists about the process of like how a song came together, like how they built it, and also about their kind of process of creating a song. And this particular episode was of a Weezer song. And Rivers Cuomo, the lead of the band, talks about like having a table of just random, you know, like funny words and phrases that kind of like have good alliteration and fit interesting, have like interesting sounds. And when he writes songs, he just kind of like looks through some of these phrases and sometimes will just pick a phrase and write a song around it, or write the lyrics around it. So it's this kind of like whimsical, semi-nerdy, structured way of writing. Like it's strange to have like nonsense and structure together, which is kind of what he's doing. The whole process is very interesting on its own. But when I saw that table, I remember listening to that podcast, being at work, and then thinking like, wow, there's so many like parts of songs that like stop me in my tracks, but I can't ever remember them. Like, you know, to recall them like in a moment. And I thought it would be really interesting to just have, you know, start putting together a list of just moments in a song that you just don't even know why they strike you, but putting those together and starting to, you know, being able to kind of look back and see if you can figure out a pattern to it. Or it's almost like, you know, I think of music as, you know, semi-magical, mm-hmm. in that we can't really understand why it strikes us, but like it can bring us, you know, to tears, or it can like pump us up. It has this like effect on our physiology and our minds in a way that is like completely impossible to understand. I think I was talking about this with somebody recently, that like music reviews, like when you open up like go on a website or open up a magazine and they're like reviewing an album, it's almost comical to like try and describe an album in words.
Yeah.
And it speaks to like how far beyond words, you know, music is. So yeah, this note that I have with this table is just full of these like little moments, like 1 minute, 5 seconds of this song, the way this chord sounds just like, you know, is incredible. Right. Like, and I just have like these moments, and it's kind of like that Rivers Cuomo table for like weird lyrics, but of like, you know, the notes and sounds equivalent of it.
I remember writing something a little bit random a few years ago. It was I don't know. Do you know what? It was probably actually during the lockdown, because when else would I have like had the time slash the space to even think about doing this? So do you guys have Lidl or Aldi over there in Canada?
No, no. What is it?
So they're like these German supermarket chains. Oh, and they right. sell like, you know, everything. But they have this middle aisle. And the middle aisle is kind of like the wild card section where each week they sell something different. And it's basically whatever they've bought in on bulk. Like you'll get like fire extinguishers, or you'll get like chainsaws, or, you know, a whole bunch of random stuff. My wife's from Germany. And so obviously we, our household is intensely passionate about these shops. And I remember going like during one of the lockdowns and seeing like this big, obnoxiously huge pair of binoculars and thinking, ah, do you know what? I'm just going to take them. And so I started taking them on my walks, and we're fortunate enough to live in the countryside. But I noticed a super weird thing happening on my walks where even if by the very act of carrying these binoculars, it made my ears like way more perceptive to bird sounds, because I was kind of like tuning in that part of my brain to look out for birds. Okay, and if I can't see birds, well, I can and can hear them. So at least I kind of know where to point the binoculars. And that's a very, very kind of like straw hat way of tying in what you've just said. Because since having that conversation with you, I honestly have listened to music in a different way. And there'll be songs that I'll hear that I'll be like, oh my goodness, the way that backing vocal hit me just at that 2:47 mark, for some reason, really, really did it for me and really moved me. And I think it's interesting how sometimes it just takes that little extra lens or way to view the world, or I suppose hear the world, that really unlocks something or allows you to kind of appreciate some of the beauty that you would have passed by otherwise. So no, I was really fascinated by that. And yeah, it's definitely a little practice that has served me well in the last few months as well.
Yeah, there's something also to be said for trying to tune into, but not necessarily explain the kind of parts, like the feelings that come over us, right? To say something, you know, struck you and like made you feel something, but not necessarily try and give it, you know, some kind of reason or explain it is something that we're not really encouraged to do. Like your day to day is very rational, right? It's like task based. It's outcome oriented. Most of what we do is you know, to accomplish something, which means it's kind of like a conscious, rational process. And music just kind of like subverts all of that. And so does things like wandering through nature, listening to, you know, hearing a bird, and just kind of like putting your binoculars up to your eyes and having a look at it and kind of marveling at it. I mean, it's sort of like when you sort of break it down, like a bird is like so easily missed or so uninteresting because they're everywhere. And yet you can kind of get lost in like looking at the feathers or the colors of one when you're looking at it through a pair of binoculars. And I've been thinking a lot more about tuning into the parts of us that are like language based or nonverbal and more just kind of like feeling based. Cause I can only speak for myself, but I think I've definitely, that part of me is definitely more undeveloped than I'd like it to be. And so the music thing is one of those things that like, there just is no way to take in music with language. It subverts all of that. And I think that's why it's a fascinating thing to sort of listen carefully and note the different parts that hit you in different ways and try to figure out, you know, what is it about that chord? Is it like, is it something that you'd heard before? Is there some kind of like fundamental, like law of the universe that makes that sound mean something or make you feel something, like minor chords versus major chords, you know, is an obvious example of like the way, like you can't say a major chord isn't more uplifting than a minor chord. And there's just no reason for that other than, you know, some kind of weird, you know, law of the universe.
Yeah. And then there's also that weird kind of paradox thing where a lot of people who have depression find that listening to like minor key piano music will actually cheer them up. You know, it's like, why does sad music make you feel better sometimes? Right. It's just so bizarre.
Yeah, and there's I heard this said once, and I think it's probably true, that the ultimate kind of low in depression, like someone who's depressed, the lowest point in a depression is someone who can't even listen to music and find any joy in it. It's like if that is failing, if that mechanism in you is failing, then you're at a very, very serious point in your mind.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, almost kind of barometer or like an artificial alarm bell that could go off. It's like, dude, if I'm not even ready to listen to my favorite album right now, like it's a good indicator of like where I'm actually at. So I want to go back slightly. You mentioned you kind of have this impression that the non-verbal, non-language parts of yourself are underdeveloped. I would just muck in here and say that's probably the experience of every single person listening to this. Why do you think that is? Like, again, not to make everything about my morning walk, but, you know, today, like in preparation for this interview, went for a walk, kind of done the usual way, and there's just little points along that walk that are just completely familiar to me. You know, I walk past this huge tree every single day. I walk past this horse every day. I walk past these ducks that are usually in the river, give or take, depending what time of day it is. And I just walk past, you know, this horse that I see all the time, and it was standing in this field beside this donkey. And I just looked at them and they were just standing in the exact same spot that I saw them in the day before. And I was like, what the heck do you guys do all day? Like, they're just like looking out at the fields, like looking at the same field they've looked at probably their whole lives. And part of me was almost like jealous, because I was like, dude, like, I'm just here on my laptop grinding away, producing, living this modern frenetic life. And part of me is like, dude, I just wish I could stand in a field all day and just learn and experience what it's like just to stand there and be content with what I can see around me. So that's a loose jumping off point for yourself. Why do you think these parts of ourselves are underdeveloped? Do you think it's something to do with the busyness and the pace of life?
Yeah, I think it's like a few things. I mean, one of them is that we've moved kind of more away from spirituality in our culture, just kind of as a sort of natural progression as we kind of learn more about the world and more ideas get shared. There's also like an individualism that causes that sort of like, I guess, fragmentation of like communities and groups. We're definitely in a time of like where everybody's opinions are competing for airtime and attention, and so therefore, like, the more different or dissonant your opinion, the easier it is to get that attention. So there's sort of a collectiveness that has changed over the last little while, and I wouldn't say it's a good or a bad thing necessarily. I think it's a cyclical thing. It happens as like, you know, a part of a historical cycle. We can get into, the idea of like 100-year historical cycles, which I've also been reading about recently, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. And we seem to be, you know, at the tail end of one of these cycles, which is kind of characterized by hyper individualism, whereas like the beginning of that cycle tends to be characterized by, like, you know, a stronger sort of collective community. So yeah, there's a little bit of that aspect, which means that, you know, we're not coming together as like a group, whether that be a group of like in a community or around like a religion, or just kind of like as human beings. Then there's, now I'll kind of like jump around in a few ideas, and you can kind of see if you want to go down any of them, but there's also this concept that I heard around like the way our perception of time changes. And it's gone from, you know, in the early days of humanity, like when we, you know, we're living, you know, more or less with all the other animals in the world, it was like a chaotic time, which means that like we didn't know what was happening and when, you know, thunderstorms would roll in and we'd have no idea, you know, just things would happen around us and we just react. And then as we started to understand the world a little bit more, we started to understand like the cycles of the world. So like the seasons, crop cycles, you know, just kind of the rhythms of nature. And that would be like kind of where we've spent most of our existence. Just understanding the cycles, you know, that we're part of like this kind of like life cycle, you know, yearly, but also generationally. And most recently, we've kind of, in the last like couple hundred years, we've gone to this more linear time where every single generation is kind of like the tip of a spear, like flying. It's almost like I picture either like the tip of a spear flying through the air or like a spaceship, like hurtling through the universe. Like all that's important is ahead of us. Everything the past was in service of just getting us here. And everybody's, you know, everybody who's alive right now is living a more interesting life than anyone that came behind. Like, who cares about the past? And, you know, because the future is so exciting. And that linear time, I think, separates us from like the sort of shared experience of like generational, you know, cycles. And it kind of alienates us a little bit more. And so I guess it's a roundabout way of kind of like talking about some of the things that I think lead us to being more rational and less content in the smaller sort of, you know, kind of feeling parts of us, like the horse and the donkey in the field. Like, they're not worried about their place in the universe. They're not, not thinking too much about, you know, being the tip of the spear of their species. You know, they're just kind of enjoying that moment. And like, if it feels good, they're doing it. And, yeah, there's something in it, all in around there. I don't know if any of that resonates with you.
No, dude, I love it. I really like this idea of the tip of the spear, especially because something I've been thinking a lot about recently is the fact that this causes a little bit of a separation between the older generation and the younger generation. So like a really low hanging fruit example is, you know, you've got the classic kind of symbol of the 5-year-old girl teaching the 80-year-old elder how to work an iPad or something like that, you know? But it's so interesting because I think because we're so future orientated and it's always about what's next, there is a bit of a disregarding of what has gone before, including some of the traditions and the practices and even just the wisdom that I think the older generation is inherently designed to pass down. And I think we move forward aggressively and incredibly quickly at our own risk or at our own peril.
Yeah, I'm really, one of the things I'm probably most fortunate about my kind of upbringing was that my family's from a like a farm, kind of a tiny little village out in Eastern Europe, and I still have like my family that lives and works on a farm, and I visit them each year. I have a grandmother who's in her 90s right now who still, you know, can tell all the stories and has a certain kind of, you know, peace and quiet about her and has like a wisdom to her as well. And I don't know that I would have, like, I feel like I probably wouldn't be able to appreciate how important that is if I hadn't actually been exposed to it. Like, I don't know if I'd read about, you know, a different kind of life that came before these kind of like current, more technologically focused times. I don't know if I'd really understand it, but being able to spend some time on a farm there and talking to some people that are living in that more cyclical time frame definitely does help. But I still find myself like anxious about, you know, am I doing enough, you know, on the tip of the spear here, you know, what's, you know, this is, you get caught up in like the importance of what you're doing right now. And yet you're really, your best energy is served to prepare, you know, the next group of people around you to keep going. And not just to like try and squeeze every last bit of your energy, you know, out or live as long as you possibly can. Or there's this kind of like nervousness around like, am I going to achieve enough in my short life, when it's kind of, that's kind of a very narrow time frame to think about.
What stops you from selling up as such and moving to the farm in Poland? You know, because I know you to be someone who's really interested in philosophy, interested in art, interested in that contemplative life. I know that you're a writer. I know that's really important to you. But I also know you to be someone who invests incredible amounts of creative energy into the professional things that you're involved in. And a big part of that is takes place in the digital world and digital sphere. So what keeps you from, I don't know, joining the great resignation and living a little bit of a monastic lifestyle?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's anything necessarily that is going to stop that in the long term. In fact, there's this idea that I live outside of Toronto, which is the biggest city in Canada, like a proper, you know, metropolis here. And the reason for kind of I've lived here my whole life, and I always thought that, you know, being closer to, you know, to culture and like the energy and the variety in a city is valuable. And I do think it's valuable. But for whatever reason, I'm starting to feel a shift where I don't need that, you know, 80% of the time. And I think the way of living in the city, your assumption is that 80% of the time, I think of it like 80-20 rule, just to give it some rough proportions, like 80% of the time, the city life is what you want. And then 20% of the time, that's sort of like quieter life outside of the city is what you want. And I feel like that's potentially switching for me, and maybe for other people too. But it's always tough. You know, this is something that I've always struggled with, is like, you know, your networks and your families, like everything you've built is kind of where you are for most of us. So, you know, to pick up and leave and move a bunch of hours away or more from all those people, I actually don't know what the impact of that is. I don't know if I want to be on my own, you know, that long or that much of my time. So I don't know, maybe one day I do move out into the woods or into the mountains somewhere. We don't have any big mountains around here, which is unfortunate, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, totally, mate, totally. So I'll stay here just one more and then we can kind of move on a little bit. I kind of have this sense that what we've been talking about is not to make things overly redundant, but there is kind of like two ways to live currently. There is plugged into the matrix in the city life, in the digital world, doing your thing, or there is that more kind of cyclical way of being, living somewhere a little bit more rural, maybe working physically with your body as opposed to with our big human brains that most of us find ourselves using in the knowledge economy. And I feel like living in both of those environments require two very different operating systems and a different set of tools to thrive and a different set of tools to be productive and establish healthy relationships and healthy practices. And one of those tools, I think, is your app, Revere, which I am incredibly impressed by, not only conceptually and the actual execution of the idea, but also as a really useful tool that I think solves a very important yet a very modern problem that perhaps we wouldn't be experiencing if we were living at a point in history where we were in those super tight-knit communities, you know, with the 150-member village where everybody knows everybody and most people are working in agriculture, or you could take it back to kind of a hunter-gatherer environment where, you know, we all go out hunting or foraging every day. And it's like one of a friend of mine describes it as a lifelong camping trip with your friends and family. And really, you know, we don't need an app like yours in those environments. But in this digital age that we're in, where we have 2,000 Facebook friends and we have, you know, tens of thousands of kind of these acquaintance connections, never mind just broader social networks, an app like yours is so important. So give us, I guess, the origin story of Revere. And tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Yeah, I think I have a bit of a mixed feeling about the app, in the sense that what I originally set out to do, you know, revealed something totally different to me about myself. I think there's probably an interesting conversation about how the projects we work on, you know, show us, will teach us about the things that, you know, the ways that we are, or the things that we need to get better at. But the app originally was to help me remember details about people, because I've, for whatever reason, have always had like a kind of a not a great memory for like specifics. And so when I'd meet somebody, I'd kind of remember them, and I'd remember, you know, generally kind of like some high level things about them, but I wouldn't remember necessarily what we talked about or the, some, you know, their kids' names or what their family looked like. So I just started writing these things down, you know, in little text files on my phone. And I realized, you know, this is great, but, you know, they're hard to search. And as you get more of them, they start to get a little bit, you know, hard to kind of organize. There's also no reminders built into the just like a notes app. So I built an app that was kind of like a bit of a notes app and a bit of a reminders app, and focused on people, because I thought that my problem was that, I actually can't, I don't remember details. And so I find it hard to like build these relationships with folks. But you know, as I started to, you know, as I built that app and then, you know, launched it and it was out there and I was using it, I realized that like my relationships necessarily weren't, you know, getting better automatically. It's like, It's like the tool I built was for this kind of like very simple read of my situation and my problem. And I realized that there's like fundamentally, you know, different things about how I relate to people that are making my relationships difficult. So it was like, you know, I thought I was building, you know, the one solution that would solve all my problems.
What are you telling me that you didn't build the killer app that finally is going to solve relationships for us all?
It's not the one thing you need to have great relationships. It actually requires a bunch of other skills and work. So that was that's kind of, you know, the origin story of the app was trying to solve that one simple understanding of what I thought my problem was around, you know, building closer relationships. And I think part of that was, you know, there's this feeling where we're, you know, we have so many people that we follow on different social media. We have like people that are, you know, reaching out to us, and we reach out to, you know, over just kind of emails and other things that we do through work. So we have like these networks of like hundreds and hundreds of people. And so it's natural to think like, well, if I could somehow, you know, manage and all that information, then my life would be easier. And certainly it would be easier, but it's kind of like, you know, trying to hold back a tidal wave, right? Like there's like at some point you just got to get out of the way or like, you know, kind of deal with it in a different way. And so, so I think that kind of speaks to, you know, to a little bit of, well, there's a bunch of topics in there, but I think it's definitely a useful app, and it helped me, but there's a kind of a way of, you know, thinking about your relationships that also has to change. You know, you can't have a close relationship with, you know, every single person. You know, that idea of Dunbar's number, the 150 people, is not non-negotiable, right? Like time is limited and relationships take time to build. So, you know, you have to pick and choose which ones you're going to spend the most time on. You can't have a close relationship with everybody.
I have to say, like, you read my mind, because I was going to mute my mic and type in like, what is that study that talks about like you can only remember a certain number of faces and names and stuff, and then you literally just went ahead. So Dunbar's number. Do you have anything more to say on that? Because I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the village that I came from that I mentioned in Eastern Europe there, and it's like a village of like 200 people, and so every single person knows everybody else, and the relationships that between people are extremely close. So, you know, if you know when I go there, I'll sit in like the kitchen on the farm with my grandmother, and you know, there's just like a constant stream of people coming in and just kind of sitting down for 10 minutes chit chatting and then leaving. Or, you know, it's no big deal to just kind of walk into someone's kitchen there, because you've got, you know, decades of relationship that have been, you know, built upon. And so that's just like kind of a natural environment for close relationships, that kind of like farm, small village farm life. Whereas we don't have, our natural environment is the opposite. It's like hundreds and hundreds of connections, very shallow. So we have to work hard to create close relationships, versus, you know, it just happening naturally. So I think there's probably like some, most of us just kind of, you know, we take, like society affects how we perceive the world. So, you know, our current society and our current culture, you know, naturally puts us down this path of shallower relationships.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is, you know, why a lot of people struggle, myself kind of included there.
It's interesting. I've been on this journey the last 3 years, and I did a talk actually at a university about it, and the title was called Deep, Not Wide. And it was all about relationships. And it actually was like comparing social media to like the siren's call in the story of Odysseus, and how they're trying to pull you away towards like the shallow and away from the deep, and how you need to set all your screens on fire and delete your social media if you want to have good relationships, you know. And now I kind of like a few years down that journey, and having stepped away from things like social media, and having really simplified the number of relationships in my life in an attempt to go deeper with them, I still, where I'm currently at is, okay, these are people that I love so much, that I care about deeply, that I invest loads of time into seeing, but frankly, there's still just too many of them. And I feel that squeeze, you know, I feel that, how can I get to that deep, deep community that I feel like we were designed for, in a day and age where none of us live in the same village? We all live, like, even if it's 20 or 30 minutes away, you know, it just makes things like those weeknight meal sharing sort of scenarios, or popping into the kitchen, as you said, it makes it more of like an appointment based community rather than an organic, natural rhythm and spontaneous thing that can kind of happen on its own. Like, I remember someone sent me a quote the other day, and they were like, why is it nowadays it's easier to get a dentist with your appointment or with your dentist than it is your best friends? And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, it just speaks so clearly to the situation that we find ourselves in. So I'm interested in Revere. How has it helped you in those closest relationships? Like, is it something that, do you have a Revere file on your wife, for example? You know, and just to catch everybody up, it's a beautiful combination of a notes taking app with a notification based app, where you can make notes on people's favorite coffee or their favorite ice cream or their favorite movies, their favorite books, their favorite albums. You can set reminders, be sure to reach out to Rabo and wish him a happy birthday or wish him good luck on the new job. So you're kind of outsourcing that details part of your brain to technology, which is wonderful. But I understand how it works in a networking environment. How about for your closest relationships?
Yeah, it's actually, for me, I think everybody will use it differently. And there's two ways that I primarily use it. One is to remember, like what the person likes, and mainly for like gift ideas. I don't know why, but I find it so stressful to buy gifts for people.
Amen.
Like I feel like I'm gonna like buy the wrong thing, and they're gonna be, you know, bummed out, but they won't tell me, and it'll be weird. I have this kind of, I've learned, people have told me like that is an uncommon weirdness you have around gifts, but it's my reality. So I often write down things like that, so that if someone's birthday is rolling around or something, I just kind of go to that and I can buy something thoughtful. And then the other thing is to remember details about what I spoke about with somebody the last time we talked, and not like in a minutes of a meeting kind of way, but more in a, what's kind of like the kind of, what's a big thing in their life that's going on right now, whether it's something that they're excited to be working on, or a particular personal area that they're focused on, or something, you know, that they're struggling with, so that if that person pops into my mind, I can do more than just say like, hey, what's up, or hey, how's it going? I can actually go into Revere, look up what I last chatted with them with, and say like, hey, how's that project going? Or how are you feeling about this or that? So I use it actually mostly for personal stuff. I find the networking stuff, for me at least, is more top of mind because you're sort of in it. You know, you're in your work like every day. So the personal stuff is kind of where I put most of my energy. And in fact, I get a lot of people that message me about that app saying like, when are you going to add some integration with, you know, my Outlook calendar or with this like sales tool? And I tell them, I say like, this is just for personal stuff. Like, it's never going to be a business tool. It's never going to be for salespeople.
Interesting.
And my goal is not to make it a huge business, but my goal is to like make it, you know, last my whole life. Because I want to have this my whole life. And part of that means like building it almost selfishly just for me. And I'm making the bet that there's other people or enough other people just like me who will be happy if I just kind of like say, well, I'm going to build it for me. And you guys are welcome to use it. But that's the only way that this thing lasts my whole life. Otherwise, you know, if it becomes a job, then, you know, that'll eventually, you know, I'll lose interest in it, and it won't be able to continue. So, and because it's for personal stuff, I think it's kind of in service of anyone that does use it, right? Like, you don't want those notes to go away. You don't want the app to disappear. I mean, plenty of these apps have gone away. There's a graveyard of these things that have come and gone.
Talk to me about the name. What does it mean for you to revere something or someone?
Yeah, it's the definition, the way I read it when I first occurred to me to name the app this, was that to hold something in high esteem. And I think that's kind of like the ultimate, you know, compliment to someone, that you would like hold them, you know, above you, or that you would like in some way that you would look to them as like a person that you can learn from or that is key to your life. So, and it's just such a beautiful word, you know, to say. It rolls off the tongue and it's really beautiful to look at, you know, just kind of aesthetically, the letters kind of, you know, have a very kind of symmetrical almost look to them, the V.
Yeah, totally.
It's, so there's just like a bunch of like nice little things. It's very short, it's memorable, it's easy to spell. So, but yeah, it all came from this idea. Like, I was like, yeah, this app is all just about, you know, appreciating what somebody means to you. And then revere is just like exactly what that feels like to me.
Mm. Awesome, man. No, I absolutely love the name. And I don't think we take enough time to revere things in our lives. And so I think it's the DNA at the core of the app is really, really gorgeous. And so no, I'm really glad you were able to unpack that a little bit. Switching gears slightly. It's the sort of thing you can never describe yourself as, so I have no problem doing it for you. You at a young age are on track to becoming a polymath. And it kind of really stood out to me. I was talking to Mark Dowds about you the other day, and he was like, yeah, you know, Rabo did this documentary, like whenever I was doing an ultra race. And I was like, what? The guy does video? And then we were talking about something else, and I was like, wait, what? The guy does this? And then we were talking about something else, and I was like, wait, the guy's also done that? How have you found hopping between different roles, different skills, and different opportunities? And is it a career path that you would recommend? Because it's often not what's recommended today. You know, it's usually like, you know, specialize in something, get laser focused on it, and put your 10,000 hours into it, which I know you have in the product side of things. But it seems to be a very kind of Victorian thing. I remember like doing some research on, you know, these big kind of titans of industry, and even just like the everyday man and woman back in Victorian times. And they would have been the type of people who, yes, they went to work, yes, they had families, but they also were, you know, prodigies in the violin, and they also did sprinting, and they also were excellent sports people and excellent painters, and. Whereas I feel like most people today have kind of lost elements of that. So do you find the multifaceted parts of yourself to be a useful and beneficial thing?
This is actually a really interesting conversation, because I beat myself up over this for most of my life. I thought that there was something wrong with me, that I couldn't find, you know, my calling or my one kind of passion. You know, even today, like whenever I hear, you know, people say, like, you know, tell young people some advice, like, you got to find your passion, I cringe. Because that's exactly the kind of language that, you know, led me down this path of kind of like self-doubt. And it wasn't until I couldn't avoid like a fundamental truth about myself, where, you know, I was like, had done so many different things and nothing could hold my attention for more than like a few years. And it's almost like there was nothing I could do about it. You know, like I just found myself like, you know, looking back and saying like, geez, like, keep changing, you know, what I'm doing. I keep changing all these, you know, careers and, you know, these disciplines. And at some point it was almost like I threw up my hands and was just like, I guess this is me, right? And there's like something there to say about, you know, just observing yourself and being okay with what you're seeing, and not kind of like comparing yourself to society. And so maybe I haven't thought too deeply about this, but my guess would be that there's some people in their experience of growing up, and combined with like the way that culture, you know, talks about the 10,000 hours and like your passion, that pushes people that would maybe more naturally be polymaths or interested in a lot of different things in a direction of like, you know, fighting that, you know, pushing against who they, like the things that they feel they want to do. But for me, once I realized that, then the game became, okay, how do I take all these experiences and bring them together? Mm. And what I do now, which is basically building, you know, software for consumer, like for people, like, you know, regular, like mass market consumers, as opposed to like businesses, for example, like it's not enterprise that my specialty is. Like, it's all the things I've done, all the different people I've worked with and different disciplines have let me sort of understand what more people are going through. So, you know, every time I did, you know, when I was doing video, I was doing documentaries, I was working in like machinery and engineering. And I've, you know, had experiences outside of, you know, my career with like, you know, motorcycles and like, you know, some shady, you know, characters in like, you know, darker sort of corners where I've kind of spent some time. But I have this appreciation of like a lot of a variety of people. And it kind of comes together when I'm building software now for, you know, the largest number of people. But that's just kind of like one small example of it. But I think the idea here is like not second guessing your behaviors, you know, just like taking those as like, okay, this is my natural way. And what can I do with this? Instead of like, I think of it as like swimming upstream. And I think a lot of what we do when we try to, you know, fit into some kind of, you know, expectation, whether it's our parents or societies or, you know, our own kind of expectations of ourselves, it feels a lot like swimming upstream. That's been the most apt metaphor for me. And recently I've just kind of started, you know, not swimming upstream, just kind of floating down the river and seeing where it goes, which is scary in its own right. Right. You're like, you know, you don't know if there's like a waterfall downstream or what's coming up. It's hard to kind of like be a passenger sometimes, but that's kind of what I would say about that. Like, it's not really a choice that I made. And maybe it's probably some combination of the way I am and just kind of like, you know, giving up the fight to be somebody I'm not.
Totally. So talk to me a little bit about swimming downstream as such. To me about being a sewer diver.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. When and why?
So this, I mean, this is very much the swimming or just like life happening, right? So I was a mechanical engineer. That's what I studied. And when I graduated, it was, you know, the goal was just to get a job because this was like a time, you know, before, you know, the social media and it wasn't before the internet, but it was kind of like before you could see a million different possibilities for yourself or like make your own career. So you graduated from school and you just started applying for jobs. And I got this one at a company that made sensor equipment that would go into like sewer systems and measure things like water levels so they could evaluate if the sewer systems were being like overwhelmed. Also, like they measured for chemicals to see, like, you know, to make sure like factories or different places weren't, you know, polluting a certain amount. So the company, part of my job was organizing these crews that would go in and kind of maintain and fix these systems. And they had this thing called, I don't think they called it Hell Week, but it was something along these lines where every single person that started working there, even if they weren't going to be the maintenance crew, had to go and work as the maintenance crew
Oh, dude, that is so awesome.
for a whole week. And so I went down when my first installation there was in Indianapolis in the Midwest of the States. And I spent a week with these guys just diving into sewers and like, I mean, you're not like literally diving, like you're not underwater. It's not that kind of thing. But like, you know, some of them are just like, you know, just up to your ankles, you know, really kind of low level, low flows. And then there's other ones, like I went down into one here in Toronto where you go down the manhole and all you hear is like this like rushing water, like the biggest waterfall you've ever heard. And you kind of drop down, you stand on this platform, and it's this kind of cut out from the main sort of, you know, pipe, which is huge. It's like, you know, whatever, 10 or 12 feet in diameter. So it's like two of you tall, and you're just watching this like shooting stream of water going across, which is like absolutely, you
It's
know,
crazy.
terrifying. But yeah, there's I don't know, like that was like there's some interesting things about these experiences that take you into the parts of the world that most people don't get to see.
The
And
underworld,
especially
bro.
it literally the underworld. And this was one of those things where you're like, oh right, there's a lot of work that goes into, you know, keeping this whole thing going. And it's a little bit more delicate than I realized. Like, do you ever like stand I've had this experience, like standing, like at the top, like in an apartment building, like overlooking a city, seeing all the lights and all the cars driving and all the stuff happening, and it's all just kind of working.
Yeah, it's
Like, ever, like,
crazy.
it's just an unbelievable accomplishment that like most of us go through our days and they're fine
But
and they're
this is why
predictable.
I love like the concept of like revering something. Like if we all were fully switched on, like anytime you went and used your tap to get a glass of water, you'd just be standing there like, oh my
In
goodness,
awe.
how the heck is this possible? And can you believe that it actually happens? And it's clean. You know what I mean? It's
That's
like,
right.
it's absolutely mind-boggling.
Well, and here's something that like by being interested in a lot of different things or even just like knowing a little bit about a lot of stuff, like you just bring like a different level of appreciation to stuff. Like, you know, when I was doing video and documentary work, you know, I can see how a scene is lit in a movie. And, you know, everybody looks at a movie and it just, if the lighting is done right, you don't even notice it, right?
Bro.
But like when you appreciate how bad natural light is and how like not real it looks when you just like if you stick a camera in a room, it will not look like a movie. You need like, you know, tons and tons of different lights and a lot of skill to kind of arrange them. And so when I watch a movie, I look at it, I'm just like, geez, like look at this is incredible. Like you just have this like next level of appreciation for stuff. I think that's what's missed, right? And also like people forget how hard, you know, it is to just kind of keep our world moving or how hard it is to like do certain jobs and we just don't appreciate, so we kind of like talk down to people or we just kind of like, you know, brush stuff off.
Yeah, I mean, some real low-hanging fruit in that for me is, you know, like most people, my first job was in hospitality at like 15 years old, and you know, I was a busboy at like a really busy family restaurant. And from that experience, it's forever changed the way I experience hospitality. Because, perfect, you know, I go in and I sit down and I'm conscious. And I'm not a details guy, like naturally, but because of that first job, I notice what way the cutlery is set out. I notice what way the napkin is, because that's all I was doing, you know, 8 hours a day was just boom, 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 laying out knives and forks, laying out napkins, arranging things on the table. And it's given me the chance to, as you say, appreciate something that I would have otherwise looked. And just as you were speaking there, I was like, dude, this is why it's so hard for me to appreciate paintings. Like, I could go into a museum and I can look at it and I can be like, oh yeah, that's nice. And that's moved me in this way or that way. But I've never painted. You know, I've never sat down to like paint my wife or like paint like a beautiful like scene of the Moor Mountains or something. So I have no technical appreciation like you do with lighting and movies towards this thing. And I'm really vibing off what you're saying here. I think that the lack of being a polymath also kind of restricts your ability to see certain things in the world. But same with podcasting, like whether you're a listener or you are a talker, doing the interviews yourself, it's amazing to expose yourself to, you know, do like a deep dive into people's professions, like, because it helps you see the world in a completely different way. So yeah, interesting point too.
Yeah, and I think even if you do only, like, let's say you have like a passion and you have like your career path and you're like, this is my jam. If you're in that position, you know that the more you learn, the more you know you need to learn, or the less you realize you know. Like, people that go super deep in an area realize that they can go infinitely deep in something. And even if you don't have this kind of polymath appreciation of, like, because you've done it yourself, as long as you assume that every single discipline could absorb a dozen lifetimes and still not reach the bottom of it, it can kind of, that thought is what kind of stops me in my tracks whenever I have some simplistic view of the world, or like somebody doesn't do something to a certain, you know, to my expectation. I realize that I stop and I'm like, yeah, I think I'm probably talking out of my ass here, because this is probably a lot more complicated than my simple, you know, high level understanding of it is. So I think I always keep that in mind, because, you know, even in the areas that I work, even when I've spent 10 years working in a particular area, I realized that I could spend 40 more and still be kind of, you know, learning stuff.
Yeah. And there's that awesome thing where, you know, it's like learning a language. I'm going to butcher the actual data here, but, you know, you can go in as a beginner and you can learn like 60% of the language in 1 year. You know, it's these huge leaps and bounds with a small time investment. But then to like master the language and remove accent and be completely fluent could then take you like something like 7 years on top of that. So by dipping your toe in the water and by really going hard at something, even if it's for only a couple of years, you can get quite a lot of mastery. Maybe like, let's say for argument's sake, halfway there without having to put in the 40 plus years to get you all the way to the 100%. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Never mind like writing a literary, you know, work in that language, right? Like,
oh, dude,
add half a century to that
yeah,
timeline, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Man, it's so interesting, the experiences we have along the way, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you ever think about like all the stories that you have to tell and all the stories, you know, of all the people you talk to. And then, you know, you just kind of look outside your window and you see like a random person walking by. There's this moment where you're like, that person probably has some epic stories as well.
Yeah. And what's that thing? Sonder. Isn't that what it is?
What's that?
No. You ever heard of that? All right. Give me a second. Hang on. Sonder definition. Oh, dude, you're going to get a lot of mileage out of this if I can pull it up. Okay, dictionary. Okay, you ready?
Go.
Definition of Sonder, noun. Throat clear. Here we go. The realization that each random passerby is living a life as vivid and complex as your own, populated with their own ambitions, friends, routines, worries, and inherited craziness. An epic story that continues invisibly around you, like an anthill sprawling deep underground, with elaborate passageways to thousands of other lives that you'll never know existed, in which you might appear only once as an extra sipping coffee in the background, as a blur of traffic passing on the highway, as a lighted window at dusk.
Wow. Yeah. That is exactly it. And it's both like, as you're saying it, I'm like, I have this like amazing, you know, excitement come over me. And at the same time, this like horror sort of insignificance. And yeah. It's like those two things colliding is like, I don't even know what to do with those two feelings, but yeah, that's wild. I think about that all the time.
Yeah, it's the hero's journey, isn't it? You know, we all are the hero of our own story, and we're supposed to be. And, you know, part of that archetype is that the hero is supposed to then lay themselves down. And actually, this was accidental, but this is a perfect tie-in to the kind of the land and the plane part of this, because I know that we are close to the end of our time together. This conversation has been incredibly therapeutic for me because I feel that tension. I talked about that squeeze earlier between being part of a productive modern society that predominantly takes place for me in the knowledge sector and the knowledge economy, where I have to use these screens that I've got such a hate-love relationship with, and then, you know, the proverbial selling up and going and living on the farm. And what has kind of just like come to me through this conversation is, no. Like, the reason why we're still in the game is because we believe that there are important things that need to happen, and that there is work that needs to be done. And if we were to step aside from that for our whole lives, in some ways there would be an element for me anyway of running away from what is hard and running away from what's difficult. That's all a very elaborate setup just to kind of end on. How did Belfast come into your story, and why have you dedicated this current chapter of your life professionally to the work that Responsible is doing? Nobody knows about it, by the way. This is probably the breaking Northern Irish news of what Responsible is, so I'm excited.
Well, let me... actually, I wanted to just say one thing about what the last point you said about, like, that kind of, you know, the moving out to the country versus, like, living in the city, the screens versus detaching. There's an idea that really kind of helped me navigate that day-to-day, because I think I'm a big fan of, like, these little tricks or these things to remember, like moment to moment, because there's no kind of, the thing that I've always struggled with is like, you know, looking for some magic, you know, idea or solution or way of thinking that will, like, you know, be the one answer to rule like all the problems that I have.
The killer app, that's what we call it.
Yeah. And so this idea, I heard somebody describe paradoxes in a really useful way. And I think the reason a lot of us struggle is because we don't realize we're actually dealing with a paradox in any given situation. So, like, the way I think of a paradox is like two opposite things that are true at the same time, right? And so much of our world and the things that we, even like the way that people talk about things, they're like, here's the one thing you need to know.
Yeah.
Or here's the answer to this question. And they're positioning these things as if they're like math questions, like there's like a one answer, but you're actually in a paradox where both things are true, or there's multiple things that are true.
Wow.
And the usefulness of a paradox for me, where this kind of came into like day-to-day helpfulness, is that the benefit of a paradox is that it forces you to stay, to always be thinking and always be ready to change. Because in any given situation, what was true yesterday might not be true today. So like yesterday, you might not have spent much time with, you know, in your relationship with your partner, say, but today it's a different day and something has happened. And so now you have to like move. So there's no, like, the importance of your partner is actually changing day to day. Or the importance of your work is changing day to day, or the importance of your like, you know, going out into nature is changing day to day. And I think that if, at least for me, thinking of things as paradoxes and this idea that like you're moving between the two extremes on a, you know, on a spectrum, and that at moments where what you did yesterday doesn't fit, it just means you need to move on the spectrum, not that you were wrong yesterday or whatever you did yesterday was wrong. And this idea of a paradox forcing you to stay, to change, is also a way to say that you're being, that you're being sort of like, I guess, alive in your life, right? You're not stagnating. It's the opposite of that. You're constantly ready to move and change rather than get frustrated that something you thought was true is not true.
Dude, this is so interesting and unbelievably helpful. Like, loads of stuff firing off in my brain right now. Like, I'm really interested in that idea of, like, you know, this fine line between order and chaos and everything involved in that. Also, there was something deep in the back of my head coming out that I'd listened to recently that talked about actually how ancient cultures were way more comfortable with paradoxes than the modern mind is. And they kind of looked at their old ancient fables and stories that they told often would be centered around paradoxes and how, you know, it's like both things are true, whereas our stories are a little bit more linear, to steal your word from earlier, where it's like cause and effect. This happens and then that happens, and it's usually like if you do the right thing then all will work out well for you, whereas like the ancient fables are like you do the right thing and then everybody still dies and everything's still terrible because sometimes that's the way the chaos of life works and things are outside of your control, you know. So yeah, look, I'm really, really interested by that, and you've given me an interesting rabbit hole to deep dive myself. So yeah, talk to me about Belfast.
Belfast, yeah. So the journey to Belfast for me began a bunch of years ago when I met Mark Dowds, the mutual friend that kind of brought us together. And I met him in he was living in Toronto. This was in my early days in the tech scene after I had left being an engineer. And I mentioned that sort of first company making those skins. That's kind of what I was doing at the time I met him. And we kind of connected on, you know, motorcycles and mountain bikes and just tech stuff early on. And we just stayed in touch and had a whole bunch of different journeys, you know, separately, and then came together for some of these kind of like adventures, like, you know, that documentary you mentioned earlier about like doing a 100-mile race. That was something that Dowds was up to, and I came to document it. And he moved back to Belfast a few years ago, and then started this company called Responsible that you mentioned as well. And it was, I was at a point in my career with the right amount of experience in the areas that were important to him that working together made sense. So, that was kind of the beginning of my work with Dowds, and Responsible. And then I had actually had, I have a connection to Ireland. My fiance, she's from County Kerry in the south.
Oh, dude, cool.
So,
spot that is! My goodness, it's beautiful.
And they're right, like they're on the water, and like in a place called Carseveen.
Incredible.
It's on the Wild Atlantic Way. So that was my first experience with Ireland, and I'd been there a few times, and then over the last couple of years, just going to Belfast to visit. And I guess not the last couple of years. Like the pre-COVID, couple years before COVID. But yeah, like I've been to Belfast a handful of times and now had the chance to stay there kind of longer term on some occasions. And I'm jealous. I think the sort of European layouts of countries and cities and the proximity to like beautiful scenery is something that is foreign to me here in Toronto, because you have to drive like an hour out of the city to kind of feel like you're in the country, just because of the sprawl of the city is very big, lots of suburbs. Whereas the greatest joy I have is like to go to Belfast and go to work there and then drive 15 minutes and be like in the middle of like fields with like sheep and rolling hills. Like, so I have a big soft spot for Ireland, and you know, to your point earlier, like it's not out of the question that I might move somewhere more kind of closer to the countryside.
I admit you literally stole my line there. I was just thinking, I was like, oh my goodness, maybe Belfast could be your farm. It's like a beautiful sweet spot. It's like a happy medium where you can be in the world but not off the world as such, if you know what I mean. So
yeah, and you know, to we've actually gone online and sort of like, you know, poked our heads into like different like home sales websites and in like the north and then in the Republic as well. So it's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, do you not just cry whenever you compare your city accommodation pound for pound, what you could get in somewhere like Ireland?
I don't want to talk about it.
Oh, dude.
We have some folks that are like relocating back to Northern Ireland at the company, and so the conversations about like, you know, buying a home, you know, has been coming up, and sure, when I hear the prices, I just like I shudder, because it's and you get like just beautiful like older kind of like classic homes, not just kind of like stuff that's been stood up as fast as possible and yeah, lower quality. So yeah, I feel like my heart is in Europe, to be honest.
Dude, those Polish roots run deep, man. Come on.
Yeah.
Generational 100%. Lines. Let's do it, dude. Let's do it.
Yeah, I spoke Polish before I spoke English, because my parents came as like immigrants. They didn't speak a word of English when I was born.
Wow.
And my grandmother raised me here. She came from Poland, and so like she didn't speak any English. So like when I went to like kindergarten, they had to send me home because I was freaking out because I couldn't speak and I didn't understand anything. And so I had to like go home. They taught me some English, or learned a little bit more English. And then I went to school like a year later. So yeah, I'm actually English as a second language, funny enough. I was born in Canada though.
I mean, there's some cool neuro pathways, I'm sure, that unlocked, that have kind of set you on your own pathway that you're on today. But yeah, stuff for another time, my man, stuff for another time. Yeah. Final question then, just as something to hang our hat on. We've left people dangling about responsible, but I'm okay with that. I'll have Dowdy on the show and he can give us the full 101 about everything that you guys are up to. I'd like to end here. It's not my question. I've completely stolen it from somebody else and I often enjoy it, but it's a first reaction question, okay? So it's not something you're going to get right. It's kind of interesting to see what comes up first.
These are terrifying, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
They plug into like your your deep subconscious.
It's here. The order, you know. It's
let's see
like
what
said,
happens.
It's the line between order and chaos. So let's just see what happens. What is the kindest thing that somebody has ever done for you?
I know exactly what it is. I remember when this is actually connects to the app. I remember, cause I'm not a programmer. So I had a lot of trouble kind of like building it at first. And then eventually I asked a couple of friends, this has been like, you know, a couple of failed attempts to build something like this, just not being, knowing like who to ask or how to make it happen. And I asked a couple of friends to help me out with it. And, I paid them like nothing near what they could get, and they had full-time jobs, so they were just kind of doing it in the evenings. And it took us about, I want to say, like 8 months to build that first version. And afterwards, when we launched, I was just kind of chatting with them, and I asked one of them, you know, I thanked one of them, and I said, you know, thanks for doing it, and I'm just curious, like, you know, why you decided to do it. And she said, I just wanted to see, I saw how important this was, and I wanted to see, like, you have this. And it was like, and I didn't realize until then that, like, they were actually, like, looking, like, they saw something in me there that was important, and that they did it not for, like, the money. And in a way, they made a sacrifice to help me make this thing real. And for whatever reason, that was like a big kind of deal, because they didn't have to do it. Like, they weren't family, they weren't close friends. They could have said no, and nobody would have thought twice about it, but they didn't. And they helped me with it. And, And I just remember kind of getting emotional there because I didn't realize like I had a relationship like that with people. So yeah, that was kind of, and you know, tying in with the relationship thing, like I think part of the app's motivation was that I never felt too close to too many people. And so to feel that as part of building this thing, was really meaningful.
Incredible, mate. Well, links to Revere will be in the show notes in the description of the episode. Also put a link to Rabo's website where you can get his writings, his blogs. He's also launching something new in that space pretty soon. So look forward for you guys to check that out as well. And other than that, Rabo, dude, just want to say thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to connect with you again. Really enjoyed you know what, mate? You just delivered exactly what I was hoping. Like, just another really interesting rabbit hole conversation that I got to selfishly just lap up. So, dude, I really appreciate you giving your time. I know it's precious, and I know a lot of people will have really benefited and enjoyed what you shared today. So thanks.
No, thank you. I love this kind of stuff, so I appreciate our chat. And I'll definitely look forward to like an in-person one when I'm in Belfast again.
Mate, whenever you move to Belfast, it can become a regular thing. We'll be doing the nature, like forest bathing and all. You're just going to be so into it. I can't wait.
Just get me a pair of binoculars.
Yeah. You know, we'll be the horse and the donkey. We'll just be standing there for hours. Dude.
We'll stand next to the horse and the donkey together, just enjoying.
Awesome.
No, it's been great. Thanks, Matt.